Welcome to Energy Law Roundup, your comprehensive weekly briefing on legal news and developments in the energy industry from Texas and across the country, always in 30 minutes or less. And now, your host for Energy Law Roundup, business litigator and oil and gas trial lawyer, Tom Charlone.
In this week's episode of the podcast, we're bringing you the third in a multi-part series of presentations that our practice group recently made to the Association of Corporate Counsel here in Texas on a variety of key legal issues impacting the oil and gas industry today. Mike Rodolfo is the head of KRCL's Distressed Strategies Practice Group. He's going to talk to us about emerging midstream and downstream insolvency and bankruptcy issues. Mike's been practicing in the bankruptcy area exclusively for almost 30 years. He frequently represents a variety of players in the energy sector, including E&Ps and service companies, and he has a substantial national practice devoted to the representation of major constituencies involved in bankruptcy and creditors' rights issues. Mike also has an intimate understanding of pre-bankruptcy workouts and debt restructurings. His practice broadly encompasses every aspect of insolvency matters, from the pre-bankruptcy workout stage through bankruptcy trial proceedings, both voluntary and involuntary, to plan preparation and confirmation, as well as bankruptcy-related litigation and the acquisition of distressed debt and assets. Mike, take it away.
So what I did here was just come up with a hypothetical, which hopefully will resonate a little bit with the audience. And we've got obviously operators and producers contract with midstream companies to use the pipeline. Pipeline has to be constructed. Pipelines are expensive. And in order to offset some of that risk, the midstream contracts will generally require producers to pay for pipeline capacity even if they don't use it, which works really well when prices are high, but not so much when prices go down. And so during the precipitous price drop that we've all experienced, producers cut production, but in many cases were stuck with burdensome contracts to pay for capacity they didn't need, didn't want to use. In the context of this type of dispute, I'm going to talk about two types of agreements which get different treatment under the Bankruptcy Code, or at least depending on which jurisdiction you're in. One is one we're all familiar with, which is a gathering agreement. It's a contract between the producer and the midstream pipeline company, and is frequently memorialized as a gathering agreement, which is an agreement between a producer of hydrocarbons and a gatherer that sets forth the terms and conditions upon which the gatherer will provide services to the current, and in most cases, very important, future production of the producer. Frequently, also very important, the gathering agreement will contain a dedication of the producer's acreage. And what this does under Texas law is it connects the gathering agreement to Texas real property law. And for reasons you'll see in a minute, that becomes significant. The two key provisions we're going to talk about with the gathering agreement that are significant in the bankruptcy context is it's intended to apply to present and future production. That goes to the issue about whether the agreements are, for example, assignable to a purchaser, whether in or out of the bankruptcy context. And then the other one, which implicates Texas real property law, is that the gathering agreement generally and usually concerns a dedicated area of the producer's acreage. The other agreement which I deal with frequently in the bankruptcy context are transportation agreements. This is a different animal than the gathering agreement for what may be obvious reasons to everybody in the room. It's a contract to provide transportation of hydrocarbons by things such as truck or rail. And it can also be in the context of a pipeline agreement, but without dedicated acreage. And that is, a transportation agreement is your conventional contract that does not touch or concern real property, does not implicate Texas real property law issues. So here's my hypothetical. A producer files a Chapter 11 and wants to sell the company. The producer is a party to a gathering agreement, or one or more, and a transportation agreement. The buyer does not want either of them. The buyer thinks he has relationships with other gatherers and transporters whose contracts will be more favorable and make the purchase more palatable for the buyer. The question is, can the Chapter 11 producer reject those contracts under the bankruptcy code so that the new buyer is not burdened with them? The answer to this depends on the definition of the bankruptcy code of what is an executory contract. That implicates Section 365 of the Bankruptcy Code, and perhaps not surprisingly for those who practice in the bankruptcy area, the Bankruptcy Code does not define exactly what an executory contract is. But we do have a definition, an executory contract is a contract that at the time the bankruptcy is filed, the failure of either party to complete performance would constitute a material breach. I personally don't find that definition to be particularly helpful either. But what is helpful is we do have some examples. For our purposes, leases are examples of executory contracts. But if the contract concerns an interest in real property, it is not executory, and thereby implicates the gathering agreement issues and a contract which touches real property. Some other examples, pretty basic. A residential home lease is an executory contract. A residential mortgage is not. It touches and concerns land. Similarly, joint operating agreements are generally treated as executory contracts, although they can frequently be recorded. They seem to implicate land, but universally are held to be executory. And therefore, what that means is that they can be rejected in the bankruptcy context. Now, fortunately for me, I didn't get to make up my hypothetical. It's a real case study. There was a Sabine was a producer in Texas, which was connected to a burdensome Texas midstream pipeline contract. But they filed bankruptcy in the Southern District of New York, which seems to be where all the fun is these days. As in my hypothetical, Sabine sought to reject the pipeline contract as an executory contract so it could negotiate a more favorable contract with another midstream company. Generally, before this case, any Texas practitioner that you talked to would have told you that that contract could not be rejected, would have told you that that contract was not executory because the contract under established Texas law touched and concerned real property, just like a residential mortgage and unlike a commercial real estate lease. What could go wrong? We've got a Texas producer trying to get out of a Texas midstream contract in New York. Asking a New York bankruptcy judge to rule on an issue as deeply steeped in Texas tradition, perhaps, as the Alamo. A ruling that the gathering agreement could not be rejected, which would have clearly severely hampered the producer's ability to reorganize. Again, what could go wrong? I will tell you anecdotally that there are several judges in the state of Texas who would love for this issue to come in their sights, because they would probably come out a little differently. But let's see what this young lady in New York did. She ruled that the midstream contracts did not concern an interest in real property and were executory and therefore could be rejected by the producer. She perceived this issue to be so significant that before she issued her opinion, she required the parties to send out notice to the 50 or 100 largest midstream companies in the country so they could listen in on the telephone while she rendered her decision. Obviously, this underscores having a New York bankruptcy judge interpret Texas oil and gas and real property law. The opinion of Texas practitioners is that she probably got it wrong, that there are so many, the notion in the Northeast, and Tom could probably back me up on this, of severed estates between a surface and a mineral is somewhat foreign, other than in places like Oklahoma, Texas, New Mexico, Louisiana. So this judge was not really drawing from a position of strength and knowledge, but this is her decision. So what came out of this is, okay, so now the producer who has contracted with the midstream company in a contract which should go in perpetuity unless it's breached by one party or the other, should be freely assignable, is not, at least not in this court in the Southern District of New York. The good news in Texas, or for the midstream companies, and maybe it's good news for the midstream companies and potentially bad news for the producers, is that this authority is not binding in the state of Texas, but it did make everybody stand up and take notice and start looking a little bit about their risks, because now you have the risk of, even in Texas, you would not think that a dispute between a Texas producer and a Texas midstream company would be in some court in Lower Manhattan, but it can happen. And the reason why that happens is because the bankruptcy venue statute still allows bankruptcies to be filed where the company has its principal place of business. That may soon change, but at least not in this context. How are we doing on time, Jen? Going back to my hypothetical, under the Sabine case, both the gathering agreement and the transportation agreement could be rejected. That left the midstream company with a very large unsecured claim and probably scrambling to evaluate its risks going forward in other contracts with other producers. The issue is far from settled. I suspect that it will end up at the Supreme Court. There's no appellate court issues, appellate court decisions on it yet. But for now, it's out there. It has potentially emboldened some producers with their midstream agreements and certainly concerned many midstream contractors as to what the downside will be. As I said, those of us who have practiced in Texas as long as I have think that that would not be the case in a Texas courtroom, but it is out there. And it is extensively briefed. It is extensively cited. There are just numerous academic articles about it, and it's something that everybody needs to be aware of because it's out there. So here's more of a hypothetical to the group. So how does this impact downstream? Who here is a downstream person? Got a hand? So let's talk about that. I'll even pick on you. What's your name, ma'am?
Kelly.
So does that dispute between the producer and the midstream company have any impact on the downstream refiner? You think so?
That's how we get some of our gas.
Right. Now, so when the gathering agreement gets rejected, you've got a potential interruption, right, in flow. And that's what we're talking about there. Now, there is an argument, on the other hand, that the downstream risk could be mitigated by a tolling agreement, a take-or-pay agreement, that even though you're not getting your production, there may be a payment required by the contracting counterparty. Of course, the risk there is that contracting counterparty has just gotten slammed from a contract that it thought it was going to have for years to come. And so there is certainly risk there. And I think at the end of the day, even though the refinery agreements, the downstream agreements, should have some risk barriers as part of them, I think that, I mean, we call it a stream, upstream, midstream, and downstream. So I think it'd be naive to think that the downstream companies would be immune from the impact of this. The good news is that right now, in the bankruptcy context in Texas especially, everybody's still functioning almost as if this decision didn't exist, but it is still being hotly debated, and like I said, I don't think it'll get resolved until we get something from the Supreme Court of the United States. That's all I have, and thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to Energy Law Roundup. If you would like additional information about anything from today's episode, you can contact Tom at 210-446-6999 or by email at tom@charlone.net. New episodes of this podcast are available every week on the web at www.energylawroundup.com, your one-stop source for breaking news and developments in energy law.